Chapter 5. Catch and Twist. The concept of catch and kill has now entered the vernacular, along with the hashtag MeToo movement and a growing awareness of the ways that wealthy and powerful men bury the truth about their predatory sexual behavior, from the rapes of Harvey Weinstein to the depredations of Trump's old friend Jeffrey Epstein, who ran a sex ring for the rich and famous at his Manhattan mansion and Caribbean island, not to mention his Palm Beach cavorting with another self-styled playboy named Donald J. Trump. The root of the word conspiracy is literally to breathe together, and that was precisely what rich men and publications like the National Enquirer did to hide the truth about exploiting and abusing women. Those rich men included my boss. The reality was far more brutal and awful than has previously been revealed, as I will demonstrate. The straightforward catch and kill is only the simplest form of the true endeavor, which is to find, stop, and spin or twist any story or rumor that could harm the interests or reputation of the rich and powerful. Sex was only part of the story, as Trump viewed anything that could hurt his brand or name as a mortal threat. Saying he wasn't as rich as he pretended to be was, in many ways, worse than calling him a sexual predator. Calling out his buildings or branded products as third-rate was far more damaging in his mind than a story about grabbing women by the pussy. The task in a catch, kill, and twist operation was to bury the truth, and if that wasn't possible, to distort it beyond recognition, to sow doubt and confusion and even fear. I knew this all from personal experience, which started in my earliest days working for the Trump Organization. In the beginning, it was obvious that my role as Trump's personal attorney was essentially managing chaos, as he was always, always, always enveloped by crisis and teetering on the brink of disaster. It was exhausting, but also exhilarating, as I always had 99 problems on my desk and 1,000 things to do. One afternoon early in my tenure, I was doing some routine work, likely cleaning up a mess made by Don Jr., when my phone rang. It was David Pecker, the CEO of American Media, on the line. Pecker was a peculiar figure in the media, a former accountant with no journalism experience who'd parlayed a bean counter's financial ability along with a canny sense of timing and willingness to take up projects most would consider beneath their dignity to become a real power in the press, running the National Enquirer and a string of smaller publications. Pecker had a signature thick mustache he'd worn for decades and a taste for the best tables at the restaurants that were the hardest to get a reservation at, the kind of prestige marker typical for New York players keeping score on their status. I would discover that Pecker's considerable power emanated from a virtually complete lack of morality or basic decency or shame, compounded by a brazen willingness to cover up rapes and assaults and despicable acts of all varieties, provided he was benefiting a powerful man and that he would receive a favor in return. In a way, he was like me, a fixer, but on the next level, with tabloids doing his bidding. Pecker's sly, secretive manner made him seem sphinx-like, but in private conversation, he was very matter-of-fact and transactional, always acting from the most reliable of motives, his own self-interest. He was a true master of the realpolitik of sex and scandal and power, I would discover, as he became a mentor and co-conspirator and then co-target of a federal criminal investigation. I'd known David for years, but this was our first conversation with me ensconced in my new role with Trump. When I started to work for Trump, another element of my curiosity was the window it might give me on how the world really worked at the highest levels. And this was my first lesson for the postgraduate degree in sleaze I was embarking on at the real Trump University, not the fake rip-off school the boss used to fleece the gullible, but the genuine PhD-level education in manipulation and control I was about to get. "Michael, I need your help," Pecker said calmly. "The husband of a woman named Jill Harth is alleging that Donald forcibly kissed her after cornering her at an event at Mar-a-Lago. It was a long time ago, in the early 90s. "What?" I blurted. "Come on, that's got to be bullshit." "Michael," Pecker replied patiently, like I was the naif grasshopper in an episode of Kung Fu and he was Master Po citing verses of wisdom from Taoist philosophy. "I trust you. Mr. Trump trusts you. Over time, you will learn that it's not about the truth. I have been watching his back for years. When I spoke to Mr. Trump about this, he told me to call you, that you and I will work together and handle these problems together." Trump and Pecker had been friends since the mid-1990s, part of the chauffeur-driven class who shared each other's confidences and operated far above the lives of the little people who have jobs and pay taxes and follow the rules. Since Trump's first flirtation with running for president in 2000 with the Reform Party, Pecker had trumpeted Trump's cause in banner headlines and fawning profiles in The Enquirer, often citing bogus polls and referring to him in sycophantic terms designed to thrill the real estate mogul as a gazillionaire. As with Trump's first lie in our first conversation, this was another moment that I might have taken a breath and given pause. The truth doesn't matter? Then what does? I assumed I was about to find out, and it shames me to say this, and this won't be the last time you'll hear me say this, but instead of wondering about the underlying morality or indeed the plight of a woman allegedly assaulted by Trump, I instantly felt excited to be included in such a small and exclusive circle. Mr. Trump trusted me? David Pecker trusted me? My chest puffed in pride as I pondered the fact that Trump only let a tiny, tiny number of his topmost executives into his inner circle, and they'd worked for him for many years, some for decades. I really and truly was an insider now, I figured, with exhilaration. "David," I replied, "tell me the allegations." Pecker offered a sanitized and abbreviated version of the story, in itself part of the way to avoid taking ownership of what we were really doing. According to Pecker, Jill Harth's ex-husband had done some work for Trump at one of his casinos in Atlantic City years earlier, promoting an event called Donald J. Trump's American Dream World Finals, a bathing beauty contest where the entrants had to sing and tell jokes. The judges were a panel of celebrities, including Trump, and there was also a hottest one-of-a-kind car design competition, all staged in the Crystal Ballroom in the Castle Resort on the boardwalk on Atlantic City. Trump had stiffed the ex-husband, Pecker explained, but worse, he'd continually hit on his beautiful then-wife, Jill Harth, propositioning her in nightclubs in Manhattan and at a restaurant in the Plaza, culminating in offering her a tour of Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach by herself and, while her then-husband cooled his heels in the dining room, showing her into his 12-year-old daughter Ivanka's bedroom and lunging at her, trying to force himself on her, pushing her onto his daughter's bed and grabbing her genitals. Ms. Harth had managed to escape somehow, but Pecker explained that now the ex-husband wanted to sell the story to the National Enquirer, getting paid for dirt on the star of The Apprentice. Unspoken was the fact that the ex-husband had no clue who he was dealing with at the National Enquirer and the real power dynamic at work. Jill Harth's former husband imagined he was talking to journalists about a potential story about a powerful figure that would be certain to get national attention. Sure, it was a tabloid, the kind of publication sold at the checkout counter in grocery stores, and of course he was hoping to make money, and the whole subject was covered in the kind of slime that would make any respectable reporter run away. But even the tenuous hold the National Enquirer had on journalistic standards, which Trump extolled when it served his purposes, even that fig leaf was a sham. David Pecker wasn't going to deal fairly or seriously with the ex-husband of some nobody woman with a long-forgotten salacious claim about his old friend. The whole concept was ridiculous. That wasn't how the world worked, I was beginning to glimpse, as I realized Pecker's allegiance was to Trump, and the truth truly didn't matter. As soon as Pecker had heard about the pitch of the hearth story, he told me, he'd intervened and done what he had done for years. Called Trump in order to conspire to cover it up, or catch and kill, as it's known. Trump had told Pecker to call me, and so it was that I was being knighted into this inner sanctum. Now it fell to me to solve this problem, I was told by Pecker. He wouldn't run the story, of course, but I needed to find a way to keep it under wraps. Walking down the hallway to Trump's office that day in 2007, I dreaded what was about to happen. I had to go into the boss's office and question him about a woman he'd, in all likelihood, sexually assaulted, a subject I felt certain would piss him off. I knocked timidly on the door, and Trump looked up from his newspaper and waved me in. I sat in the middle red egg chair and gulped, figuring I'd use indirection and express my gratitude instead of putting Trump on the spot. It felt like obsequiousness was necessary, as usual. "I just heard from David," I said. "I am honored that you feel comfortable with me handling these types of matters for you." "You know David trusts you," Trump said. "So do I. Just don't make me regret my decision." "Never, boss," I said. "Are the allegations true? Do we have a contact number for her?" "I know she called Rona a few times," Trump said, not answering my question. Again, par for the course. "Man, she's really great looking. She's in love with Trump. Go get the file of her emails from Rona and then handle it with David. No stories on this, got it?" "Of course, boss. I know what to do." "Let me know how you do," Trump said as I left. Trump's assistant, Rona Graff, had her own office, and I was surprised that when I told her what I was after, she nonchalantly opened a filing cabinet and flicked through scores of files, finally pulling one out and handing it to me. It was like troubles such as the one I was now charged with dealing with were a matter of routine, and scores of others had made similar allegations. Back in my office, I opened the file and read the emails from Ms. Hearth to Trump. There were notes seeking employment as a makeup artist for Trump on The Apprentice and as his personal stylist. The emails expressed admiration for the boss, and there was no mention of sexual assault or improper behavior. They were most definitely not the kind of notes that might be written by a woman who'd been attacked, or at least that was how it seemed to me. Like the letters of recommendation for Trump University, which purported to speak to a 98% approval for the transparently worthless degree, the backstory to Ms. Hearth's emails was no doubt more complicated. Not many people come into contact with the fantastically wealthy and the entree into their world and the economic benefits that come with such proximity. As I knew all too well, there was an urge to please and stay in the good graces of a man with Trump's power, and victims of sexual assault often act in ways that don't seem consistent with the aftermath of an assault, as we've all learned in recent times. In truth, Trump had stayed in contact with her long after he stiffed her husband and the business she had run with her ex, telling her that she was married to a loser. She thought of Trump as a stalker and sued in 1997, but the case was settled out of court, along with the claim by her husband for money due for the Atlantic City event, a way to disguise the payoff to cover up the story about sexual assault, the ex-husband believed. The embittered ex now wanted revenge, and I had to stop him. To catch and kill the story as instructed, I picked up the phone and dialed Jill Hearth's cell. A man picked up and I explained who I was, a process that I loved and that almost always had an incredible impact. My title as Executive Vice President and Special Counsel to Donald J. Trump had a hypnotic effect, I could see, especially on everyday people. I then asked to speak to Jill Hearth. "Sure," the man said without asking why I was calling. Hold on one second. Hi, this is Jill, Ms. Harth said pleasantly. I knew right away from her tone of voice, even knowing that this was Trump-related, that she wasn't going to be a problem. So I played nice. I'm sure you know about the allegations being raised to media outlets by your ex-husband, I said. I do, she replied. I hope I can count on your assistance in refuting these malicious statements, I said. I went on. I see that you have kept in contact with Mr. Trump over the years. My subtle or not so subtle way of letting her know I'd read her emails and was aware of her pleas for employment. What I need from you is a statement emphatically denying the allegation. With both parties denying what is being said, any reporter would have to include both statements in a story, making the allegations look like a hit job on Trump or just irrelevant. For 20 minutes, we talked about the best way to proceed. Bizarrely, perhaps, we never talked about the truth of what Trump was supposed to have done. As a woman, I guess she understood that what Pecker said was absolutely correct. The truth didn't matter. She wanted to work as a makeup artist and stylist, and a man like Trump could provide her the connections that would change her life. This was the underlying bedrock truth that was actually the central reality of the exchange. Jill Harth knew that if she went along with me, there was a chance she might make money, and conversely, if she didn't, she would be fighting against forces that rendered her not just vulnerable, but defenseless. Through my office, Trump could crush her like an insect. That was the subtext, and even as we talked politely, the stranglehold of money and power was on her throat. Yes, that was what I did, and yes, I know how wrong it was, but not at the time. I had no second thoughts or scruples, and it never occurred to me that there was no way to reconcile what I was doing with how I wanted my daughter to be treated or my son to behave. That was what depravity looked like. Depraved. You know, if I ask him to give me a job, he will, she said, a forlorn attempt to assert some version of her own purchase on power. I will see what I can do, I replied, not quite dismissively, then reminding her of the real power at play. But first, I must get the statement from you so we can put this issue to rest. Okay, she said meekly. We crafted a statement, by which I mean I crafted a statement that she went along with, creating a narrative that was false, as she knew, and, sorry to say, so did I. The statement was thus ready for any reporter who pursued the story. This wasn't pure catch and kill, as Trump didn't pay her for her silence and I didn't quash the story. I did something slightly different as I learned the martial art of hiding marital infidelity. There was no media organization on the planet that was going to run a story based on unsubstantiated allegations of an aggrieved ex-husband that both his ex-wife and Trump denied, not without at least including the denials. It made no sense to publish what has been twisted into nothing more than unprintable nonsense. The story disappeared for nearly a decade, until Trump ran for president and she tried again to get work from the boss, which, in my line of work, constituted great success. Do me a favor, Trump told me when I presented him with a copy of Jill Harth's phony statement. Make a copy of this and take it upstairs to Melania. Let her know this whole thing was bullshit and the ex-husband was trying to make a few bucks. Will do, boss, I replied. Trump sighed. She really was great-looking back then, he said, reminiscing fondly about the attractiveness of Jill Harth and, without doubt, the time he'd stuck his hands between her legs and groped her. I called Melania as instructed, and we performed a game of kabuki theater, each of us aware of the deception, but following an unspoken rule that we wouldn't acknowledge that reality. I told her about the false accusations circulating regarding Jill Harth and the story her ex-husband was trying to sell about Trump trying to force himself on her. She listened silently as I described the mutual denials, all while I could tell she knew I was lying. "I don't care what people say or write," she said. "Thank you for letting me know." But she knew. She knew everything. But she didn't do what most wives would do and insist on the whole story. Back in my office, back in a place I'd begun to feel comfortable, useful, and like I belonged in a way I'd never really experienced before, I waited for my next assignment. Like everyone else at the Trump Organization, I was tasked with hunting for real estate deals for the company, but I was also a businessman running my own money, and I occasionally came across an opportunity that was too small or off-brand for Trump, but that fit me perfectly. That was what happened when I identified a 90-unit rental apartment building in uptown Manhattan that was up for sale. The price was excellent, and it had a stable history of good tenants, so I took a run at acquiring it and was actually able to finance and close the deal. When I proudly told Trump about the $58 million purchase, his mood soured and he got petulant. "Why didn't you bring the deal to me?" he asked. "It wasn't big enough for you, boss," I said. "It wasn't your kind of deal." "You didn't give me a chance," he said, sulking. "Remember, you work for me first and foremost." I was a little disheartened, mostly because I'd wanted to share the pleasure of the art of my deal with the man who'd supposedly written the book. But I knew his anger was exactly the same as the emotion he aimed at his children. Trump only cared about subjects that concerned him and his benefit and well-being, so anything that detracted or distracted from the complete and utter focus on him and his ego was a waste of time and energy. The rejection was weirdly a kind of compliment from Trump, in that he was treating me just as he treated his children. Badly. One of the more unusual aspects of working for the Trump Organization was how an entire floor of the Trump Tower was turned into a Hollywood soundstage for episodes of The Apprentice. Trump would call me in his gruff voice, like Don Corleone, and say I should come to the set to watch the proceedings. For days on end, I would sit in the control booth witnessing the antics, part of my job description that might give you a sense of how damn fun it could be working for the Trump Organization. Yes, Trump yelled and screamed and bullied, and I was one of his favorite targets for derision and insults, and yes, he asked the impossible and required that no one around him ask any questions or doubt his word, and yes, much of what I did was morally and legally and ethically repulsive and soulless. But you won't understand the full picture unless you can grasp how incredibly entertaining it was not just to watch the insane spectacle of manipulation and debasement that constituted reality television at its highest level. I was part of the action, in on the joke, the recipient of Trump's knowing winks and grins. If Trump was playing the world for a ship of fools, a common denominator of confidence artists all through the ages, then at least I was his first mate, or maybe more honestly, lackey. It was kind of like the old joke, and I loved old jokes. I was a member of New York's legendary private comedians club, the Friars Club, and often attended their celebrity roasts, where the circus worker is shoveling elephant shit and someone asks him why he doesn't find a better job. "What?" he asks. "And leave show business?" That was me, shoveling shit, but part of the show. Trump's older kids were co-stars on the show, and it was evident that they were thrilled at all the attention and glamour associated with performing in the top-rated reality TV show. The same was true for some employees, like Trump's assistant, Rona Graff, who appeared occasionally. I wound up as co-president of the production company that made The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice, and I routinely suggested people I'd met as contestants. But it wasn't long after I started working for Trump that the global financial crisis hit the real estate industry. Trump likes to pretend he'd foreseen the disaster, much as he liked to lie about opposing the Iraq invasion of 2003 from the start, 2020 hindsight being a specialty of his, but he was as clueless as any average Joe, I can attest with absolute certainty. When I signed on to work for Trump, I assumed he was a multi-billionaire with hundreds of millions in cash on hand at all times, ready to pounce on an opportunity at a moment's notice. What I was discovering was that Trump wasn't nearly the man advertised in The Art of the Deal. To start with, after 2008 and the free fall in value of his various real estate holdings, including Trump Tower and his golf courses, he effectively dropped out of the building business. "No one is going to develop properties in this market," he told me. "You'd have to be out of your fucking mind to try to sell condos in this market." Thus did Donald Trump's supposedly triumphant career as an iconic real estate developer end. Quietly, with no fanfare or acknowledgement. He still pretended to be a builder, and it played a big part in his coming political career, but the truth was that he turned virtually all of his focus to tending to his brand licensing deals. There would be an occasional exception to this rule, like the acquisition of the Doral Golf Course in 2011, but Trump spent his waking hours chasing money from endorsements for products like Trump Steaks and Trump Vodka and, infamously, Trump University. He'd endorse pretty much anything as long as he had a piece of the action and didn't have to put up any money. This hardly was the expected activity of a billionaire investor, of course, and I often wondered about the truth of his net worth. Trump certainly fixated on my growing wealth from my real estate holdings and taxi medallions. He frequently commented on the amount of money I had as a way to throw it in my face that he was so much richer than me. It was like water off a duck's back to me, but it fed his need to demean people around him who had the temerity to get ahead in life. Success was always a zero-sum game for him, and he alone, had to be the winner. Calculating Trump's real net worth was one of the strangest and most telling aspects of life in the Trump organization. When Forbes and Fortune and the other publications that measured wealth were compiling the list of the richest people on earth, Trump would go into a frenzy. He would have CFO Alan Weisselberg and me concoct the highest possible number, inflating the valuation of his buildings and golf courses by using the absolute most optimistic comparable properties, and then we'd juice that number and juice it again and again until the boss had a number that satisfied the requirements of his ego. Conversely, as you'll hear in later pages with potential criminal consequences, when it came time to pay taxes, an obligation Trump didn't minimize or avoid, but rather almost certainly illegally evaded, the same properties would be deemed essentially worthless, or better yet, the subject of giant capital losses which he could then deduct. I remember sitting in Trump's office on the 26th floor when a tax refund check for $10 million from the government arrived. He held the check up for me to see, flabbergasted, but also delighted. "Can you believe how fucking stupid the IRS is?" Trump asked. "Who would give me a refund of $10 million? They are so stupid." But the biggest thing that was happening in these early years was that I was becoming fluent in Trump's secret language of silences, nods, and signals to the degree that I was turning into his alter ego. In the 1980s, Trump had had a fake spokesperson named John Barron, who would call tabloid reporters to boast about the boss's sexual prowess and all the beautiful women he'd dated. It has always seemed more than a little odd that his youngest son's first name is Barron, though whatever that might indicate, I'll leave to the shrinks. In the 1990s, the avatar was named Johnny Miller, and he would shamelessly brag about Trump's wealth and sexual conquests in a voice that was uncannily like the boss's, because it was his voice. These semi-comical charades were transparent to most every reporter, but they served a mutually useful purpose, providing lazy journalists with easy headlines and also shoveling coal into the always red-hot furnace of Trump's ego. In the 2000s, Trump came up with an even better idea. Instead of using a fake character, he developed a real live double who could speak to the press on his behalf and shamelessly extol his truly incredible, mind-blowing, unique, and huge talents. That person was me. I was his John Barron and Johnny Miller. In that capacity, I kept up a constant stream of calls with journalists at the New York Post and the Daily News, as well as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the National Enquirer. In truth, my most important task was learning to channel the voice of Donald Trump and to convey his thoughts on any subject without having to ask him what he wanted to say. I was like Howdy Doody or Charlie McCarthy, a ventriloquist doll speaking for the boss and faithfully saying precisely what he would say, no matter how crass or stupid. In many ways, I wasn't really a lawyer for Trump so much as a surrogate and attack dog with a law license. Along the way, I got involved in all of the wacky business ideas that Trump got involved in, many of them of the white trash and violent variety. One of the little appreciated ways that he connected with the white working class people in the Midwest who propelled him into the White House and remain his base of so-called deplorables. Professional wrestling was one of Trump's earliest connections with the tastes of baseball cap-wearing, pickup-driving men who otherwise would seem a million miles away from Trump's pampered and gilded gold existence. Fast food, trash TV, leering at attractive women, Trump channeled blue-collar white men because that was part of how he saw life, but also because he knew he could make a buck that way. In 2009, Trump made a deal with his friend Vince McMahon of World Wrestling Entertainment to appear in a WWE Raw stunt. In this charade, McMahon would sell WWE Raw only to later learn that it was his nemesis, Donald Trump, who was the purchaser. I was tasked with reviewing the agreement and making sure that Trump received the agreed-upon fee. Trump had a long-standing relationship with McMahon and loved the bread-and-circus aspect of wrestling, with the phony plot lines known as kayfabe pretty much exactly matching the nutball narrative he carried around in his head about life, politics, and the intelligence of his audience. One afternoon, Vince McMahon came to Trump Tower to go over the plot they'd stage for the event, which involved Trump slapping him in the face. To rehearse, McMahon asked Trump to stand up and slap him. Trump was reluctant. "I don't want to slap you," he said. "I'll hurt you." "Don't worry," said McMahon. "Give me a real slap, not a soft one. The crowd needs a real slap." "Really?" Trump shrugged and gave him a soft slap across the cheek. "That's a girl slap," McMahon said. "Let me have it. Reach back and put your whole body into it." "Really?" McMahon nodded. Trump was grinning now, clearly enjoying the idea of being able to slap someone around with no consequences, indeed, to get praised for it. Trump was a big man, 6'3", easily 275 pounds, and even though he was in terrible shape and flabby, I knew he was plenty strong. Trump reared back as we all flinched in anticipation, apart from McMahon, who was also obviously enjoying schooling his new pupil in the finer points of fake violence. Then the boss smacked him hard. McMahon rubbed his face while the crowd in Trump's office giggled in disbelief. "Okay," said McMahon. "Now, really let me have it." "Oh, man," Trump said, this time really letting go and giving him a very hard five-finger smack across the face and nose, the crack of skin on skin echoing into the hallway like a slap shot and causing all of us to burst out laughing as McMahon rubbed his ruby-red cheek and chuckled. "This is going to be some show, Vince," Trump said. "We'll make it look real for them." "Yeah," said McMahon. "Real, real." We all flew to Green Bay, Wisconsin for the event titled Trump, the new owner of WWE Raw. All of us invited were eager to experience what we knew was going to be a wild, fun night. In the dressing room under the stadium, we could hear the mounting noise of the crowd coming in, and it was obvious that the place was going to be sold out, not to mention the huge pay-per-view audience. This was when Don Jr. spoke out of turn, at least in the eyes of his taskmaster father. "Hey, Dad, are you nervous?" he asked. "What did you say?" Trump asked, his face reddening. "I'm going in front of millions of people. What kind of stupid fucking question is that? Get out of here!" We all stood in awkward silence, staring at our shoes, feeling sorry for the son and his perfectly innocent question. "God damn it," Trump said with a heavy sigh, as if his son wasn't present. "The kid has the worst fucking judgment of anyone I have ever met. What a stupid thing to say, to put that thought in my head." Don Jr. said nothing, also inspecting his shoes, and no doubt desperate to flee. The hurt was evident in his face and demeanor, even though this was hardly the first time I'd heard Trump insult his son and remark on his supposed lack of intelligence. I often wondered why the son stayed around in the face of the abuse of his father, though I knew the answer, because Don Jr. had told me the story. A true outdoorsman who would be most at peace raising cattle and hunting buffalo in Montana, after college, he'd gotten a job as a bartender and enjoyed the work and the separation from his distant father. But after a couple of years, the elder Trump presented his son with an ultimatum: work for the family business or be cut off entirely. In effect, disowned and disinherited if he didn't serve at the beck and call of his father. Don Jr. hated real estate, office politics, the whole circus that surrounded his old man, but he didn't want to be exiled, so he resolved to tough out the worst parts of being a Trump, including being humiliated in front of a group of colleagues by his own father. I really felt for him in that moment, as his father fixed his tie and adopted his scowling stage presence to enter what amounted to the 21st century version of the Roman Forum, the roar of the crowd above now echoing in the hallways. "Are you okay?" I asked Don Jr. as we made our way out to the ring and were out of the earshot of the boss. "I'm all good," he replied, putting on a brave face. "We have a tortuous relationship." It's not the first time he said that, and it won't be the last. The location in Wisconsin was no coincidence as an epicenter of Middle America, and I've often wondered how many swing voters Trump might have won that night at the Resch Center with over 10,000 fans screaming and yelling like lunatics as Trump appeared walking towards the ring for the bout dressed in a pink tie, black suit, and black knee-length overcoat, his face set in a grimace that made him look like an overgrown version of Bart Simpson. Trump loved being the heel, wrestling parlance for the bad guy, knowing that the script called for him to win, naturally, and then engage in the emasculating and mock spectacle of selling the Raw company back to McMahon for a quick, hefty profit. Trump slapping McMahon was supposed to get the bout off to a frenzy-making start, but the boss got swept up in the moment as everyone watched him strut up to McMahon and then ferociously slap him in the face. Trump slapping McMahon shocked the crowd as they watched the skit play out on the Jumbotron, hearing the thunderous slap while the camera zoomed in on the five-finger or triple F imprint on McMahon's cheek. I'd never seen the boss look so happy. He loved trafficking in violence or the threat of violence, as could be seen during the election campaign when he implored his followers to beat up a protester at a rally in Las Vegas in 2016. "I'd like to punch him in the face," candidate Trump said as the protester was roughed up. The crowd in Wisconsin went wild, as they say, and in this case, that was exactly what the insane intensity of the live audience felt like as they cheered on Trump, a wealthy celebrity who viewed their form of entertainment as worthy of his attention. So, WWE Raw was part of my job description too, and I loved it. Life with Trump was filled with improbable, even unbelievable events that contained their own logic but mostly revolved around an ancient Roman piece of wisdom, Carpe Diem. When Trump dispatched me to Fresno in Northern California to try to secure the right to develop a giant golf project called Running Horse, I embraced the outrageous and audacious approach of Mr. Trump and immediately started promoting our bid the way P.T. Barnum would have. I went on radio stations, extolling the awesome super-luxury nature of Trump's courses, how we would build condos and gated communities and a PGA championship-level course on the 1,000-acre site. I set about trying to convince the Fresno City Council that they should finance the cost of the development out of a bond issuance, explaining that the Trump Organization was bringing unparalleled expertise and excellence that would lift the economy of the entire region. I checked in with Trump multiple times a day as he urged me to even greater bombastic heights. But as the weeks passed, it became evident that I wasn't going to convince the local political class, including a rising star in the Republican Party named Devin Nunes, to make the population pay for a billionaire's golf course. Soon after the Running Horse project fell apart, I was assigned to a project in the Meadowlands in New Jersey for the development of a 1,000-apartment golf course community to be built on a massive landfill near the Hudson River. The proposal was failing and needed a brand name to revive it, and so entered Donald Trump's personal attorney. The idea was to create the technology to properly vent the landfill so the methane and other gases didn't cause an explosion, and then have a world-class course within easy driving distance from Manhattan, enabling Wall Street players to hit the links anytime they wanted. But chasing deals was a tricky and uncertain matter with many more failures than successes, no matter what Trump claims about winning all the time. And this idea didn't pan out either. Trump didn't take setbacks well, to put it mildly. His form of leadership revolved around anger, fury, rage, and always chaotic blaming and shaming. I was no different than the Trump children, who caught hell when they brought a deal to their father that wasn't a home run or didn't happen at all, though that was inevitable. I had befriended a Saudi prince who wanted to invest his family's billions in the United States, so I introduced him to Trump in the boss's office. But nothing came of that, apart from the pair of diamond-crusted sunglasses my Arab acquaintance gave me. To be on the receiving end of a Trump tirade in the aftermath of the financial crisis was nobody's idea of a bargain. He belittled me and shouted and mocked the smallest aspects of my appearance or manner in a way that would normally drive any sensible employee to seek another job. But the magnetic pull of Trump was irresistible for me. For every ridiculous rant, there was a WrestleMania, or a head of state stopping by the office, or a tabloid rumor about an apprentice sexual scandal to put down, and the sheer pace and variety of life in the swirling tornado that always surrounded him was addictive. I was like a junkie, mainlining the excitement and the rush of people and money and craziness about as far from my staid white shoe law firm existence of recent times as can be imagined. When Trump hinted to my colleague George Soriol that I ought to quit and work elsewhere, I immediately went into the boss's office and asked if he wanted me to go. I was fine with leaving if that was what he wanted, I said, but he backed down right away, maybe to avoid direct conflict, which he despised, but mostly because he knew he'd stumbled into a useful and effective advocate willing to do what was required come what may, which was a rare and valuable commodity. There was also the fact that I took on the slimiest assignments without complaint. One of the worst was cleaning up the mess in the aftermath of a clusterfuck known as the Trump Network. This brilliant idea started soon after I began to work for Trump and essentially involved a couple of operators who sold vitamins and supposed health pills and supplements who approached the boss about a multi-level marketing scheme. The structure was like Amway, with each commission-based salesperson paying the person above them in the pyramid, thus the pejorative term, P. pyramid scheme to describe what was really a scam. The way to keep the Ponzi scheme ticking along was to have more and more salespeople signing up to continually increase the payments being kicked up the ladder. But the problem was the most basic of any business. The products didn't sell. I'm not sure if it was quality, or whether or not the vitamins actually did anything, or bad marketing, or bad design, or the Trump brand having no earthly relevance to a health-based product. But the company was a total failure, and I was tasked with exiting the boss in a cost-effective and timely fashion. Trump suits, Trump ties, on and on it went with product lines. When the clothing company that made Trump suits approached the company about partnering on a line of Trump-endorsed pay-per-view mixed martial arts promotions to be called Affliction Entertainment, the boss assigned me to lead the initiative. Like Trump, I liked fighting in business, but also in the ring. Only in my case, that meant actual combat. Muay Thai, the Thai form of boxing, is sometimes called the art of eight limbs, referring to the elbows, hands, shins, and knees, all deployed to defeat your opponent, which was a pretty good analogy for what it was like working for and with Donald J. Trump. As the chief operating officer of Affliction Entertainment, I was charged with making sure Trump got his cut of the proceeds, even if the company fell apart, as it soon did. The boss didn't want to share the losses, of course, but he wanted what he considered his guarantee for putting his name all over the rings used for the two promotions that actually got produced. One evening, I was in the Hamptons having a heated discussion about Trump's fees with the president of Affliction and the distribution partners who had done business with Affliction Entertainment. Things quickly got out of hand in the limo we were riding in along Montauk Highway, and a fistfight broke out between us. The fact that I was willing to literally, physically fight and punch another man in the face on behalf of Mr. Trump should give you a sense of the lengths that I was willing to go to please the boss, much to the ongoing and growing disgust of my wife and kids. But I couldn't quit working for Trump, I knew. Not for the money, as most think, but because by then I was obsessed with him, not as an acolyte or hanger-on, but as a way to stay close to his celebrity and glamour and power. I was the canary in the coal mine for the millions of Americans who are still mesmerized by the power of Trump.